Hello, a Sick Career Podcast audience. On today's episode, I am very excited to have Sybil Patry on the podcast. She is an Indian woman, very impressive track record. She's worked at some of the top financial companies in the world, including BlackRock, American Century, other great organizations like that. She's got ridiculous certifications, a chartered financial analyst, a CFA. We talk a little bit about that. We talk about some of the challenges that she's had despite her amazing background, her amazing skills, the amazing effort that she puts in, that despite all that merit and despite all those skills and capabilities, the challenges that she's had as a person of color, and more importantly, what she has done about that and what she is doing about that going forward. So I think you'll really enjoy this conversation. We talk about personal branding, taking ownership of yourself, speaking up when things are not so cool, and really all about owning your career. And as a reminder, if you're ever looking to get a better job, if you're having trouble getting more interviews, more offers, or more money, we at Kadima Careers can help you. Just go to kademacareers.com and you'll find to group coaching, to do-it-yourself courses. We are here to help accelerate your career. And with that, I will leave you with my three favorite words: own your career. Hello and welcome to another Sick Career Podcast. Today, I am very excited to have Sybil Patry on the podcast today. Sybil and I met how I meet pretty much everybody nowadays on LinkedIn. I saw a very vulnerable, honest, and open post that she did after she had some difficult challenges in her career and workplace. And she didn't allude to so many details there, but it was clear that she has had some challenges in some not so great workplaces over the course of her career. But I really appreciated her authenticity, her vulnerability, and her desire to support others on the platform. So I'm going to hand the mic over to Sybil. And Sybil, welcome to the Sick Career Podcast. And please tell the Sick Career audience a little bit about you and what you're doing.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me, Alan. It's really nice to be here. And it was great to meet you on LinkedIn. I have been in financial services for the past 20 years. If I go back a little further, my parents are immigrants and I kind of had a scrappy immigrant background, had no idea how to navigate America, much less corporate America, but I somehow did for 20 long years. And during that time, I got my master's, got my CFA, got my CAIA, which is an alternative investment specialty certification, really just to prove to everybody that, hey, I belong here. I deserve to be here. And I've been at a lot of different firms, both big and small, in asset management like BlackRock and Oppenheimer Funds and Deutsche Bank. And currently, I am not working for the past month. So I'm really excited to be here and I'm excited to talk about my journey.
Cool. And I know what the CFA is. CFA is a chartered financial analyst. It's a really tough certification to get. Very few people actually pass. I think there's three rounds of certifications that you need to pass. And it's as intense, if not more intense, than getting an MBA, from my memory. Yes. That's why I chose not to do it when I was an analyst. Kudos to you for putting all that hard work and getting that. What's a CAIA? I haven't heard of that one before.
It's a chartered alternative investment analyst. So it's similar to the CFA, but it focuses on alternatives, mostly illiquids like private equity, private debt, and kind of shows you and kind of teaches you how to analyze and value the private side, illiquid side.
Awesome. So you have about like a 20-year career in the finance sector. Would you say that finance defines you, or like at least what I'm seeing about what you're talking about on LinkedIn and elsewhere? I don't really see you as a finance person. I think you've grown and had a strong career in that finance area and had tremendous accomplishments, tremendous companies. How do you consider finance as part of you and what you're doing now?
You know, finance was all of me for so long and my career and my credentials were my identity. I wore them like my badge. The one thing that I didn't really do was post a lot on LinkedIn until a couple of years ago. And I just stayed in my bubble of work and trying to move ahead and things like that. And to be honest, I never really thought that posting about how I feel about inflation or interest rates or certain things going on with certain companies, I didn't see how that truly added value because so many people were talking about it already. Like, what am I going to say that is so different and compelling? And that's why I never talked about finance on LinkedIn, even though I could have. I had the credibility to talk about it. I could have talked about a lot of different things. It just never occurred to me that it would really be value add.
And your LinkedIn tagline is strategic change maker focused on flipping the status quo. And I've seen, and you've seen from a very different perspective as a woman of color versus me, a pasty white dude, what some of the status quo has been. What is some of that status quo that you've seen that is really motivating you to say, hey, enough is enough. It's time to flip the script on this. What are some of those current situations that just ain't so cool?
It's the whole imbalance of power. I think that's what it really comes down to. And when I wasn't actually looking for power and I wasn't actually looking for a seat at this table that everybody talks about, everything was kind of okay. I'm getting my paycheck, I'm getting my benefits, and financial services can be like a cushy place to be and it could be very comfortable. But when I realized that I'm actually pretty freaking good at this. And when I do get to sit at these tables and use my voice, I have really great ideas. People took my ideas, took credit for my ideas, and they became successful and I didn't. And so I realized that there is this huge imbalance and I had the audacity to think that I belong there too. When people saw in me that I had this audacity to want to be promoted, to want to be in the C-suite, to want to run these businesses, something changed. And it was like, no, not her. I mean, she's good for us taking from her. She's good for her like running projects, but not to be an actual voice, not to be a decision maker. And that's for a couple of different reasons. One is this implicit bias thing. Not a lot of leaders in financial services look like me. And that's just true. Like you said, the CFA is really hard to pass. When I passed it, I don't know what the percentage of women of color or Indian women taking and passing the CFA was. I think I was like literally one of the only people. And still, I don't know that many women of color that have the CFA designation. So there's this bias that that's not what a financial professional looks like. But there's also more than that. When I started actually sharing my authentic self and sharing some of who I am and my culture and my background and the things that I care about, that didn't sit well with the leadership positions that really didn't want to shake up status quo. It's about, let's be nice and let's be kind and everything is a meritocracy. And I was like, no, it ain't. It is not. And being nice isn't going to solve the world's problems and it's not going to solve corporate America's problems.
Oh, and the whole meritocracy fallacy pisses me off to no end. All these companies talk about meritocracy and everyone's going to get promoted based on their merit and everyone's going to get opportunities based on their merit. And I would say it's loosely correlated. You have to be generally, not always, but there's a loose correlation with merit, with promotion and opportunity. But you definitely see some people that are tapped by senior leaders that are the nephew of a senior leader that know how to play the internal politics more effectively, that are moving up further ahead than people that may not have that advocacy, that support, regardless of the merit that they've earned and they've really actioned themselves. Are there any particular examples, without naming names or institutions, where you first started to see that this fallacy of meritocracy was really a fallacy and not how the game was actually played?
As you were talking, I feel like I'm about to coin something new. It's mediocrity, not meritocracy, because that's what I saw a lot of, let me tell you. I was tasked with working on ESG, which is environmental, social, and governance. It's a big thing to do with sustainable investing. And when I am asked to lead something, I do it 150%. I got an award from this firm for my work on ESG and diversity. And one of the things that I suggested was we really need to do a sustainability review, like a report, because we don't have that yet. And so let's talk about what we are doing as a firm, you know, grade ourselves from an ESG perspective and corporate responsibility and all of those things. And let's put it out there, even though we're not required to, because we weren't a public company. And that was my passion project. And I worked on it. I got a resource, a writer, and we worked on this project. We pulled from really great sustainability reports that we've seen online from competitors. We created an outline. We got the content together. And then it sat not going anywhere for a while. I tried to tell my manager, like, hey, I'm doing this thing, but it was viewed as a passion project. And then I went to marketing and I said, hey, I'm doing this thing. It's going to be great. Let's put it out there before clients start asking us. If you don't tell your story, somebody else will tell it for you. And that was how passionate I was about this. It ended up going nowhere. Total dead end. I had to just file it away as something that I tried. And maybe 6 months later, somebody else who happened to be a white man came out and said, hey, I have this great idea to do a sustainability report. I was a footnote in this, but he got promoted to be the head of sustainability. He took my draft and then actually got it published because they listened to a white man saying this is important and not me. I was left with being really angry and really upset. But if I came across at that time, if I said, hey, but I did that, the response would be, well, isn't it good that it actually just happened? Isn't it great that now we have somebody dedicated to this? Not only did I do the paper, have the idea for the paper, put it together, get a writer involved, I wasn't even considered for that position.
Wow. I'm sorry that you went through that. Unfortunately, it's not the first time I've heard stories like this. I've seen it in my own household with my wife. It's really just the systemic system of mansplaining and white men, not all white men, but enough white men that are holding other people down. And without saying names, but you've worked at some very impressive institutions that generally have some very good reputations. And I'm guessing in those situations, you ran into lots of great people that you're probably still friends with, and maybe pockets of people like that you dealt with here. Do you think that there's any corporation or organization that women, people of color can be part of where they're not going to potentially either experience this directly or be at risk of dealing with this? And based on that answer, I want to go into how you would suggest that women, people of color, deal with that.
I have been at many different organizations and all the experiences have been different, but there has been enough commonality for me to say, like you, this is a systemic thing. But in order to talk about, are there companies where we can thrive? I think it really depends on what you're looking for. Like I said, I was audacious enough to think like I wanted to be at the top. If you are looking for a manager that values your opinion, is inclusive, provides psychological safety, I am sure that those managers exist. Now, when you're talking about a whole entire organization, at least in financial services, I'm not sure how much. So it really depends on how much you can take and what you want your career to look like. If you're looking for a paycheck for your family, if you're doing work that you love. For me, I couldn't find that. I couldn't find what I needed, the place that I needed to feel psychologically safe and thrive. But I think that there are ways, and I'm actually excited to think about those ways because I do want people that look like me and don't look like me to thrive in those places. I don't want everybody to just leave. Like, we need to be able to stay and change systems as well.
Yeah. And I've worked at some of those sort of financial institutions that you've been part of. I was at CIBC, I was at UBS, I was at in investment banking and equity research. I saw it inside the walls as a white dude invited to these meetings. And sometimes I got invited to meetings with the CEO. I met with Steve Wynn because I was invited to the table with him.
Yeah.
he didn't do anything outrageous then, but he actually had a reputation of doing outrageous things then. I was warned before the meeting. He won't remember me. I was just one of like 20 people in the room at the time. And I've also been at institutions like American Express, which is much more women and family friendly. And I've been at some tech companies like Google and Facebook and Salesforce, which generally talk a lot of good game about psychological safety and a culture of acceptance. But I can say that while there was definitely a difference in percentages of good environment versus toxicity, as I went from investment banking to American Express to tech, there were always pockets of the antithesis of what you're talking about. The antithesis of support and psychological safety and advocacy. And like you mentioned the word systemic, and I do believe it's systemic, not just in corporations, but in society in general. If it is systemic, are there some places that people can aim for that will be less likely to run into those? But it sounds like every organization, every situation, you're probably going to run into something. So are there ways that you can kind of control for less of a shitty situation?
I think so. And I think one piece of advice I would probably give my former self, which kind of helps answer this question because I know I'm not answering it directly, is just know that your job and your title, that's not your whole entire life. And for a long time, even up until this year, I was obsessed with making sure that I did everything perfectly and I went above and beyond. And I think it's okay not to go above and beyond. It's okay not to get like the highest performance rating every single time. And it's okay to have a more integrated work and life. And it's okay to dial it back and push on boundaries that are important to you. Because while you're going through the grind, you might think, oh, well, I need the next thing. I need the next promotion. I need them to see me. Now I have to go into the office all the time. But you're actually missing out on your life, like the part outside of work. And any company that says work is family, I would say just like run away, because work is not your family. They're not your family.
You're not inviting your boss and your team. Like in my case, my kid's bar mitzvah. I don't think like whatever holidays and family celebrations you celebrate.
Yeah. And it's fine to say work can be a community, but family is totally different unless it's a really shitty family that will fire you and like kick you out and not help you through healthcare or whatever. I mean, it is so insane to say we're like family or we are your family. And I think that's one thing that everyone, and then, you know, especially people of color and minoritized people need to realize that you need to have your own network, your personal brand, like who you are, which is kind of what you've seen me posting about outside of this work. And I think that will help you center yourselves and not be as like psychologically damaged or traumatized from these work situations.
And it's interesting. I know you do a lot of work on personal branding, and let's talk about that. I first heard that term in 2005, 2006, when I was at American Express. Like, hey, you need to work on your personal brand. I understood high level what that meant, but I kind of thought it was just some BS. Talk to me about why you think that's so important, how that has empowered you throughout your career.
Most of my career, my personal brand was be perfect, don't be authentic, and just be as professional as you can, be as polished as you can, and show up and deliver 150%, because I was really trying to prove myself and I was seeking validation for a whole host of reasons. That can work. I've had a successful career, but toward the tail end of the 20 years, I realized how exhausted I was by not actually being myself, by not expressing myself the way that I normally do. Like when you're just sitting there on a comfy couch and you feel like, okay, I belong here. You know how a lot of white men just shoot the shit and talk about shit and they're just like, whatever.
I just think that's people, but it might be like, because I'm a white man and I'm probably hanging out with more white men than women and people.
In corporate spaces, yeah. Like yeah. The meeting before the meeting, yeah. When people get together and they're like, how was your weekend? And they talk about football and things like that. If there's not a lot of people that look like me and do a lot of the cultural things that I do, I'm just going to smile and nod. And so that's the context for that. I think you're right. Like if you're in a space where you belong, you can do that. In corporate, right, that wasn't the case for me. And so 3 years ago, everybody started talking about DE&I. It was this big thing. And I was always very into like wanting more representation at the top and knowing that representation matters. And so when I saw this huge push for DE&I, I think it was like 2017 to 2019 that I saw the huge push from corporate, I welcomed it. I thought like, this is awesome. They never talked about this stuff 20 years ago. Yeah, I'll be part of the committee. Let's create some ERGs. Like, I'm all about this. And I was a little naive at the time because I started stepping into my authenticity about the things that I cared about outside of work. And I think many others thought, wow, work is becoming a safe place to bring in more of our authentic selves that we normally hide. And so I started doing that. And then something weird started happening. I was praised for it. I met people like you literally because I started posting on LinkedIn. And so that's fantastic. But then also there was a lot of pushback and a lot of risk involved with me being authentic. And maybe 3 years ago, I didn't realize that because I was a little naive. I mean, I was very cautious about what I posted, but I was a little naive and thinking like, okay, well, they want me to be authentic. And so I'm just talking about how I feel about different things that are affecting our lives, which are also affecting us professionally. So I like talking about personal brand, one, because mine just happened like super accidentally. And like I said, if you don't tell your own story, someone else is going to tell it for you. But what I realized is, what are the things that I'm talking about? What are the things that are appealing to people? Let's just use LinkedIn as an example. It was always when I was vulnerable, and it was always when I was talking authentically about really hard stuff. And most of it had to do with work and corporate spaces, but some of it had to do with social justice, but it all had to do with me as a human being navigating work and life. And I know that it belongs on LinkedIn because it is professional. Like, just because a bunch of people said golf and talking about that as professional, you know, that became so. And so, yeah, let's make talking about social justice professional and our culture and the things that we care about and our core values. Like, these are what make us who we are. And it's a huge, huge benefit to the workplace. And so I would say really be intentional about building your brand. I did it accidentally, and now I'm doing it on purpose. And it is very risky, but it is worth it.
Let's talk about some of those risks that you took and the decisions behind those. And we don't need to go into explicit details, but I really am very impressed with some of the decisions that you've made, not to get too hung up on the sunk cost fallacy. So you've spent 20 years in your career to have this ridiculously impressive career. It may not have always been as easy as it looks impressive on LinkedIn, but you've got lots of promotions, lots of great companies. You have a CFA, which is really hard to get. And now you are entering a new chapter. And I don't think you're going to be applying your CFA to your next chapter. And we can talk about what you're going to be doing next. How did you think through that of like, hey, this was my former identity. I've invested 20 years, hundreds of hours probably studying for the CFA, passing it. And maybe you got it on all three tries right away. You probably did because you're a 150% type person. But a lot of people fail one of them and they only are given once a year. So it could take multiple years. You put so much into this career and you're not tossing it behind. I think that has informed you. But how do you think about like the 20 years, the CFA, the brands that you have on there, and now pivoting? And then let's talk about the thought process of pushing that, like putting that behind you, not ignoring it. And then we'll talk about where you're going.
I have a huge lump in my throat from everything you said, because it is the freaking hardest thing that I had to do. And it took me at least 2 years, maybe more, because I don't know when the wheels started churning in my mind about, am I in the right spot? This is my career. This is my livelihood. Alan, I try to stay with every fiber of my being. If financial services and my last company was a person, I was holding on for dear life. And I was begging. I mean, and I don't cry. I cried. I broke down. I was like, I want to stay. I need to stay. I need to make it. And I think the reason why it was so hard was because I actually really, really enjoyed finance. I really enjoyed my job, and I enjoyed especially things about impact investing and how we can use investing for good and getting more diversity. And I got stuck because I started being seen as sort of like a diversity person. And I was like, oh, heck no, I'm not a diversity person. I'm a finance person. Just because I'm a brown woman doesn't mean that I am here to talk about diversity. But yet there I was being asked to speak at things and do things for diversity. I was pushing back against this diversity thing so hard because I'm like, that's not me. I want people to know me for my CFA. I want people to know me for all of the things that I've done in finance. And I tried to stay. I tried to create new job opportunities that would give me a job that I wanted to build businesses, to do impact investing. All of it in finance, nothing to do with social justice other than, you know, the impact element of social justice. And I failed. I mean, I'll let you in on a little secret, Alan, and people that are watching. I believe that I was pushed out. And we don't have to talk about specifics, but when somebody says we don't want you anymore and you beg and beg, it's like a toxic freaking relationship. And the reason why it took me so long to leave was, one, the immense grief and loss of losing my identity, of everything that I feel like I work so hard for. And two, I knew deep down inside that if I leave my last firm, I will most likely leave the industry because everyone was like, just go find another place to work. I couldn't explain it. I can't do it. I've been at other places. I've actually been at a lot of different places. You know, I've been at places for 2 years and left, and there's a reason behind that. So yeah, that's a really tough one to talk about, but I realized, and then that's kind of how I'm pivoting into what I'm doing next. I can't stay in a system that doesn't work for me and other people that are so horribly excluded. I have to do something to level set or to help reset the system, not just for me, but for my kids and for the future. So that took a lot of for me to be able to say, like, I might be walking away from this career as I know it.
Well, I appreciate your courage there. And there are a couple of things. One, there is always a two-way door, although I don't know if you want to go back into that door, honestly, like based on some of the limited stories I've seen on LinkedIn. And I know you haven't shared everything, but like what I can imagine a little bit from what I've seen and imagining how difficult it could be at times. But let's talk more forward of where you're going. What door are you opening and where are you headed next?
So I'm really excited and very scared. I'm launching my own business. It's called In Pursuit Collective. And the reason behind the name is that, you know, for most of my life and my career, I've been chasing and chasing and chasing these goals and milestones that a lot of people do, right? Like, what is success and what does that look like? And every time I reach the next thing, I still felt a little empty inside. And so In Pursuit is really about, what am I in pursuit of? And what are others in pursuit of? And how can we get there sustainably? And how can we get there in a way that doesn't harm other people? And how can we do that in liberation? And it's very different than what I've done before, but it's also, it ties in so much of my background of what I've done before. And so I'm offering three things. I'm offering coaching, mostly for BIPOC executives and for people that really feel the way that I did. I wish I had somebody to help me through what I went through, like a coach that looked like me. I think the coaching industry, you know, everybody's a coach now, and I get that. And I was like, do I want to say that I'm a coach? But coaching is a privilege. 10 years ago, I didn't even know what coaching was for. And now I'm getting my certification and I'm like, wow, so eye-opening and so inspiring to even know like a coach approach. I use it with my kids now. And so many people of color and so many minoritized people don't have access to coaching and don't even know what it is. So yeah, there aren't a lot of coaches of color. It's a very non-diverse industry. And so I'm hoping to bring my own expertise of 20 years in the corporate space and then also being the coach that I sort of needed. And my coaching is also going to be trauma-informed because a lot of people that are racialized or have dealt with situations that have been unfair because of what they look like or their gender or whatever, there's a lot of trauma there. And the people don't realize that don't treat you with the care that you need to be treated with. And I've experienced that with HR and other people that I thought were there to help me. And I'm like really going through something so difficult, so emotional. I want to have a trauma-centered approach. And so that's not therapy. That just means like, I see you, I see what you're going through and I believe you. And let's figure out how you can get to a different place, whether it's in your own firm or whether it's leaving, you know, let's figure out a solution for you that will make you happier. And so that's my coaching. I'll also be doing some collaborating with mission-driven startups and small companies. And that's really using my 20 years of financial services and corporate strategy experience. I will have a social justice lens on everything I do because it is important. It's important to have a reset and a rebuild of our systems. And finally, I'll be doing some speaking. As you can see, I have a lot to say and I've learned a lot. And I believe that this needs to be shared. I don't want to keep things to myself. If I have wisdom that I think that can help other people, if I make mistakes in my business, you're going to hear about it. I'm not going to say like, oh, look, everything is perfect. I just want to share all of it so that other people can learn and grow from my mistakes.
Well, that's very noble. And I appreciate that. And one thing that you mentioned in there was you thought like that HR was there to help you. And one thing that I always try to convey to people is HR is really the wrong acronym for it. It should really be CYA, cover your ass. That is what HR exists for, is to cover the company's ass from litigation, from keeping people at bay. This is not to discredit all people in HR. There's fantastic people that go into HR, into recruiting, talent acquisition, leadership development, because they are good people and they want to help. But the reason why the companies are typically hiring those people and spending good money for large HR organizations is to mitigate risk for the company and to help get people in and out of the company with minimal litigation.
You're so right. And I know that too. And I think I wasn't so naive about the HR thing. In the beginning I was, but you know, 3 years ago or whatever, I knew a little bit more about HR. But I think what I was naive about was like humanity. So if you're in a room with one other person and you're looking at them in the eyes and you're telling them I'm hurting and I need help and I actually need somebody to help me with this situation, that person also has children, and you feel like maybe humanity isn't lost. And then you remember that most companies are soulless corporations. You're right. The liability. I did forget that for like a couple of seconds and a couple of like very vulnerable moments. And I will never forget that again.
And I think it goes back to the fallacy that the company is your family. It's not your family. It just happens to be a community of individuals that all chose to be employed at will by BlackRock in your case, or Google in my case, or whatever company. And they happen to be at that company at the same time that you happen to be there. And there might be good people, and there might be not so good people. Some companies might have a higher percentage of those good people, and some might have less, but you really never know who you're dealing with. But it sounds like you've run into lots of good people that have inspired you and motivated you along the way as well. And on that note, like this will be the last question before we wrap things up. Were there any advocates or mentors, either in the workplace or outside of the workplace? I think you're a very powerful woman in terms of taking agency on your career, of what you're saying on LinkedIn. I highly encourage people, and we'll talk about where people can follow you. You say some pretty pointed stuff on LinkedIn. So how did you become like this? Is it family members? Is it work people? Because I'm guessing you weren't just born like this. Maybe you're born a little bit like this, but also people have supported you like this.
That's a great question. I actually have to thank a lot of my LinkedIn community for bringing this out in me. I think it was in there somewhere and it was buried among fear and wanting status and possessions and things. Elizabeth Leba, She is amazing. Do you follow her?
I know her. I've spoken to her. I'm trying to get her on my podcast. Yeah.
Oh, she's wonderful. She wrote a book called I'm Not Yelling, and I literally thought it was about me. It's about Black women, so it's not about me, but it's fantastic. And the way that she is so unapologetically herself is amazing. And I've spoken to her kind of throughout when I was going through, it's really hard and it's really isolating when you're going through such a tough situation. And she was like, it gets better. And when you feel liberation, where you know that you are going to say whatever you believe in, no matter what, there's just so much liberation in that. And that doesn't mean hurting other people or being disrespectful, but that just means knowing your truth and speaking truth to power. And so there are so many others, but she just comes to mind because I'm just a huge fan and she has really inspired me.
Awesome. Well, Sybil, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I love learning about you and your experiences and how you're helping others on LinkedIn. And now that you'll be speaking more about it, I can't wait to hear that more unfettered. And you've been fairly unfettered in a lot of your talk, but now that you're not tied down by the corporate chains, I don't know if that's the right term, but I think there'll be some more interesting words and wisdom coming out from you. So I'm looking forward to hearing that. The last two questions I always have for my guests are, what is one piece of sick career advice that you'd like to leave my listeners with?
One of the things that I talk about in my new company is imagine our collective strength if we weren't at war with oppression. And it sounds heavy, but what it really means is just take me, for example, and what I could be doing in the world and what I'm doing instead. Many of the people that are talking about DE&I and social justice, they're not doing this because it's like super fun. It's not fun. We're doing it because we feel like we have to, but imagine what we could have been doing instead. And I think about that a lot. And so for anybody else that is feeling that they want to do something, just keep that in mind. And maybe you can also explore like your social justice or DE&I side and activate. Because if we all talk, then it's going to be really loud and then they have to listen.
I think that's a great point. Like, be mindful of those oppressive tactics. And I think it, in my mind, something that I've related is people can take an abundance mindset where there's plenty to go around for everybody. And you don't need to hold people back because there's plenty to go around. Or you can have a scarcity mindset where these diverse individuals are trying to take a piece of my pie. I say bullshit. The earth is pretty darn big. There's lots of opportunity and we can actually get more together than alone. But I'll get off my soapbox there. And then the last question I'll have for you, Sybil, is where can people find you and how can people support you in your efforts?
On LinkedIn, you can follow me at Sybil Patry. Also on Instagram at Sybil Patry. And I just started a YouTube channel, so I'll be posting more on YouTube as well. My company is In Pursuit Collective. So you can go to the website, www.inpursuitcollective.com. And you can see what I'm up to there. And if you want to work with me, just shout out. I'm also available for podcasts and speaking.
Awesome, Sybil. Well, thank you so much for the generosity of your time. I really appreciate the conversation. I love learning from you, and I can't wait to hear more from you.
Thanks so much, Alan.
That wraps up another remarkable episode of the Sick Career Podcast with Alan Stein. Check out past episodes and other resources on the website. That's sickpodcast.com, and it's S-Y-C-K. Alan, tell the audience about the newsletter they can sign up for.
Newsletter rocks. Check out the accelerator, XLR8R. You will get great tips about your career. You'll get honest insights. You will get the occasional pet picture. And you will learn how to take proactive control and take charge of your career.
Very good. Very good. That's sickpodcast.com, S-Y-C-K. For your host, Alan Stein, I'm Russ Reba, and we hope you've enjoyed today's episode. You are going to love the next one.